It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The average full-term pregnancy lasts 40 weeks. Premature birth is defined as birth that occurs before 37 weeks of pregnancy. One in 10 babies in the United States is born prematurely. Although premature birth and related complications are the number one cause of infant death in the United States, advances in medical science have made it possible for doctors to save even the smallest babies, babies called micropreemies, born weighing less than 1 pound, 12 ounces, or before 26 weeks of gestation. Later this hour, I will talk with two doctors who care for these tiny babies and their mothers, but first, the story of one incredible little girl. Her name is Kerrigan Knipp, and she's almost 2 years old. She was born at 23 weeks and 6 days gestation. That's more than 4 months early. And she wouldn't be here without the hope and tenacity of her mother and father and an incredible care team at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Livia Knipp is Kerrigan's mother. She lives in Windsor Heights, and she is with me now. Hello, Livia.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to go back in time a couple of years ago to when Kerrigan was born. And you were pregnant. Kerrigan is your third child. You were expecting her to be born around the 4th of July. Was your pregnancy pretty normal up until the point that things went wrong?
Yes, it was exactly like the other two pregnancies, which were both exactly the same. Nothing out of the ordinary at all until one day everything changed.
Right. So you had a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old at home.
Correct.
And you were working. So I can't even imagine how crazy your life must have been at that point.
I was very overwhelmed by the idea of a morning, how a morning was going to look, getting three kids out the door.
Sure, absolutely. Yep. So one day you're at work and your water breaks. Tell me what happens.
Yeah, so I had literally just said something to someone about, oh, don't worry about it. I think I'd eaten some sushi or something. And then I realized 20 minutes later, my water breaks. And I thought, that's insane. Right. I didn't understand that my water had broken quite yet. I knew something was off. I just didn't know. So I did a quick Google search, gush of water, 19 weeks. And forums are like the first thing that come up. And it says, that happened to other people and their baby passed away. And I'm still at work and my phone rings and I have to take a mortgage application. And I end up staying at work about another 2 hours before I made it. I drove myself to the emergency room because things were not getting better. It just was getting crazier. My water was literally just breaking.
And right.
So,
and at this point, you thought that this was the beginning of a miscarriage or the beginning of losing your pregnancy?
Yes and no. I don't know. When I got into the emergency room, that still hadn't hit me. I told my husband to continue doing what he was going to do that night, and my mom had come to be with me. And when they checked to verify that, yes, it was amniotic fluid, they said, okay, we're going to take you into labor and delivery. And that's when it was like, I was shocked. Even though I had read quick blurbs on those forums, I think I was in shock and I didn't understand fully, but that's when I started to, and that's when they told me, yes, you're going to have this baby in a couple of hours at the most, like maybe sooner than that even. So yes, and that's when they told me it would be considered a miscarriage. They had told me to start, one of the nurses said, well, you could start planning a funeral, and then reminded me, oh no, it's a miscarriage. It was bizarre because in my head, I'm halfway done with this pregnancy. Like this is our baby, you know?
And then you still hadn't seen your doctor yet at that point.
Correct. Oh, and I was using the midwives, and a midwife did come to me that night, but the doctor, this would be usually when I think a doctor would have taken over, obviously, because it's no longer just a healthy, normal birth. And the doctor, I didn't get to see a doctor till about 16 hours after I had entered the hospital. And the part that I find disturbing is that I was offered to induce labor at that point before I even was ever given a diagnosis or told what exactly this was. So I didn't actually have anything to like try to Google. I didn't know that it was called PPROM. And I think a couple hours later after the doctor left, I go, what did he call this again? Like,
right. And you were 19 weeks along at this point, which is incredibly early.
Yes.
And so you were not getting any kind of encouragement. You chose not to be induced. You
Correct.
Chose to wait and see. But at that point, nobody had said anything that made you believe that there was any possibility that you could save your daughter. And
correct.
You decided to post about this on Facebook. And in a way, that was what really started the ball rolling that allowed you to save Kerrigan. Mm-hmm. What happened when you posted about this on Facebook?
Yeah, so I spent 3 days in the hospital, two and a half. Well, I spent the weekend in the hospital. Sunday I left, and then Monday I decided, you know, let's just, I was trying to get all the prayers I could possibly get because that's what we needed. They had told me it would be a true miracle if my water sealed back up and that probably was not going to happen with me because it was a total rupture and there was no amniotic fluid. So I went on social media and I felt weird about it. Like, I hadn't even put out that I was pregnant yet besides in a Christmas card. And so I just said, we need your prayers. Our family needs your prayers. Pray for a miracle. That's probably not going to happen, but pray for a miracle that my water seals back up because I truly thought that was the only way the baby could survive. Pray she remains comfortable. I had had one ultrasound the day after I got into the hospital once I hadn't delivered, and she just was crumpled up on herself. That used to just make me cry just thinking of her being uncomfortable in there. And then just pray this is happening, so pray it's no more traumatic than it already has been, which of course it would have been, but that's how little hope I had. And hundreds of people started commenting, you know, praying. And then a friend from Iraq, I'd been in Iraq when I was in 04, and I hadn't seen him since then, but we were Facebook friends. He said, my cousin had a baby that she had this happen, and the baby survived. And that's honestly the first I'd heard that a baby could survive and live a normal life. So, and then another friend said this happened to my friend or our neighbor's friend up in Clear Lake, and to reach out to this woman. And so that's what we did.
Wow. So that's Carrie Tisdall.
Carrie Tisdall, yep.
And her water broke it at 22 weeks?
22 weeks, correct.
All right.
Yes.
So later than yours.
Yep.
But again, I mean, a micro preemie, 22 weeks is just over that halfway point. Mm-hmm. And when you talked to Carrie, what did she say to you?
So the first thing she said, you have to go to Iowa City. You have to go to Iowa City. I told her little bit of our story, and she was like, get into the car now and drive there. And I thought, well, I mean, they can't do anything. Still, nobody's going to be able to save this baby. It's still too early. And anyway, so I did not just jump into the car because that was scary in itself and to be 2 hours away. But also, she started telling me, like, just everything about how they treated her, how that she was able to breastfeed. She was going to start talking to a doctor right away about me. And so she just kind of started the ball rolling and got these people to know about me. And I spent the weekend like thinking about it, like it was going to be hard to be away from my two kids. But then I realized if I'm here at 22 weeks, the baby will just be put into my arms to pass away. I would have had a 58% chance in Iowa City that this baby's going to live. And I could live with whatever happened if I knew I did everything possible. And so I just knew. I said, no, we have to go to Iowa City. There's no reason to just stay here and just chance it, because if I knew, if something happened, you know, how would I live with that? And so I called to get my care changed over. And then Dr. Warnemont called me and asked me to tell a little bit about my story. And the first thing she said was, we have hope for you. And I will never, ever, ever forget that, because I hadn't been told anything remotely close to that before. And so Dr. Warmont's very special to me for just that one sentence.
Right. At this point, I mean, you had lost your amniotic fluid. You mm-hmm. were also bleeding quite heavily because, mm-hmm. as you discovered with the ultrasound, you had placenta previa, which meant that the placenta was lower. So the placenta was in between your cervix and the baby.
Correct.
And so there was a lot of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And you were still pregnant.
Mm-hmm. I took off to Iowa City just so I could be in Iowa City in case something happened that night. Because obviously, like I said, I wanted to do anything and everything. No, I did anything and everything. And what if it happened at 21 and 6? And they actually, I believe, will try that early. I know they will. They will try that early. So I went and stayed with a friend who just happened to be a labor and delivery nurse at the hospital who was on maternity leave. And so
it's hard for me to understand, and we'll talk more with doctors about it in a little while, how Kerrigan was still developing without any amniotic fluid. When you got to the hospital in Iowa City, what happened next?
Well, there was They were so insanely kind. I'll never forget just walking up to even to the front desk for my first appointment and the kindness that came from the woman just across from me, because that's not what I'd experienced during this whole process before. And they took me in, they did a ultrasound right away. And so I had had two ultrasounds since my water broke, but no one ever told me I had previa. And so I was just bleeding at home. And what can happen with previa is a mother could bleed out, I guess.
Bleed to death.
And so I didn't know that. And I think they had, someone later told me, had they known that ahead of time, they would have brought me in even sooner to be just under their care. So I kind of wish I would have known that. Maybe I wouldn't have been so scared at home for so long. But yes, they do an ultrasound right away. And then they explained, okay, we do not, our goal here is to get you to at least 24 weeks. And we're at 22 and 0 days because we do not want to do, they don't want to do the more dangerous type of, I think it's called classical C-section. But at this point, you would have to have a C-section. You know, our hope, they will let you stay pregnant till 34 weeks if you can, with PPROM. And when that happens, a lot of times early on, if the placenta, I guess, is where mine was, the hopes is that you would grow and that it would move upward as your tummy gets bigger. But obviously, you know, every day I'm fighting to keep this baby in, so we don't know when that's going to happen. So that was kind of the scary thing I learned right away that made me nervous. And then they just do a bunch of things to you, and there's a lot of prodding and needles and whatnot, and you start antibiotics again. And but oh my gosh, the nurses and everyone was just so amazing. Everyone that came in and saw us, and my mother-in-law brought my kids in for a surprise visit, and after everything was done, so that was nice.
I'm talking with Livia Knipp. Her daughter Kerrigan was born at 23 weeks, 6 days gestation, a micropreemie. We'll find out more about her birth and care at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital in a moment. I'll also talk with two doctors who care for these tiny babies and their mothers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're learning about the care of micropreemies, babies born before 26 weeks gestation or weighing less than 1 pound, 12 ounces. With me now is Livia Knipp. Her youngest daughter, Kerrigan, was born at 23 weeks, 6 days gestation. That after Livia's water broke when she was only 19 weeks pregnant. Before the break, Livia, we were talking about how you transferred your care to the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, and you managed to stay pregnant for another 13 days after you were admitted. The position of your placenta meant that you would need to have a C-section. What happened that made your care team realize that now was the time for a C-section?
It's crazy. I just had dinner that night. My kids had been there that day, and we did library time at the library, and I started feeling kind of weird, like just uncomfortable, but it seemed about once a week I would have this, like, just not feeling great, not definitely not labor, but just not feeling good. And then I went to the bathroom, and things just didn't seem right. I pulled the emergency cord, and next thing they know, they said, call your husband. He needs to drive here. And it was a really scary night. And I couldn't get the words out. I can't even hardly get them out now. And so the nurse said, get here. We're going to try not to have this baby, but it might be happening. And it was the amount of blood. So I truly was in labor. They just weren't taking her out because of the blood situation. Mm-hmm. But my husband drove like 95. He still didn't believe we were having a baby. He brought his work clothes for the next day and his CrossFit clothes. And
right. When Kerrigan was born, she was 1 pound, 6 ounces.
Correct.
So
yes.
About the size of a 1 liter water bottle. Just tiny, tiny baby.
Think tiny and then think tinier. That's how small they seem. Like, you just can't even believe it.
What went through your mind when you finally got to meet her?
I don't remember if I cried. I'm sure I did because I cried about everything. But I couldn't believe it. I think I said, is that a piece of masking tape and a cotton ball for a diaper? And they said, no, that's a real diaper. But her diaper, if you can picture a third of a dollar bill, that's how big it was.
Just so tiny.
Yeah.
And She was in the NICU for, was it 135 days?
Yes, 135 days.
And they have to work hard to try to basically recreate that environment that she's not ready to be out in the world. And they're worried about lung development and heart development and eye development and so many different things. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there was a whole story every day that you were in the NICU. Mm-hmm. But how did she do? What, as far as the kinds of problems that a micropreemie can encounter?
Honestly, she did amazing. Like, I went to a conference on micropreemies that Iowa City put on, and I feel like hearing them talk, the doctors talk, she went through the process as I think they would hope. She did have pulmonary hypertension, and Dr. Klein will be able to tell you all about that. I think I didn't even realize how scary that was. We had, I think it was Easter morning that year. That's like really the only time they called and said things are not going well. And that was a horrible, horrible day, a horrible thing to wake up at, you know, 2 a.m. I had a special ring for when the NICU called. And it was crazy. But she was tiny for one. Her lungs were underdeveloped because of not having the amniotic fluid for 5 weeks. But really, I feel we were insanely lucky. There's so many other things that could have come up. And I never left. In the 135 days, I went home 6 times, and I never stayed for more than 20 hours. And I got used to what she did. I knew her better than anyone. And that's what, one of the amazing things that Iowa City will tell you always is, like, you know this baby better than anyone. So when they come around for rounds, if I've noticed something, they would take in what you're saying, and they would consider that, and they would make changes sometimes on things that I noticed. So I always thought that was amazing how much respect they give to the parent, because they know, especially if they know you're there every single day, 12 hours a day. Right. And that's what I did. So
135 days, that's forever. and forever to be away from your other children. That must have been really hard too.
Yes.
So tell me, she's 22 months now. She'll be 2 years old in March. Tell me about Kerrigan now.
Oh, she is hilarious. I wish everyone could meet her. She's so normal but funny and like wise beyond her 2 years. And she did get off oxygen in May, and then she got put back off on oxygen in September. And so she runs around all over the house, literally runs now, and with a 50-foot cord behind her, and it's constantly getting stuck on things. It's got, I think I just unwrapped a purse, a shirt, and a bungee cord from it yesterday. It could drive a person insane, but honestly, I think your whole perspective changes. And when you mentioned the 135 days, Dr. Klein told me on early April that we were going to be there till November. So 135 days felt like nothing.
You felt like
because
you got
I
out
was
early.
Expecting to be there until late October, November. I know everything just changes. Your whole perspective changes. So her running around with a 50-foot cord, yeah, it's annoying, but she's live, so it doesn't right. It doesn't matter. Everything's.
She does wear glasses. Change. A lot of micropreemies have need glasses because of their vision, and she also has a whole slew of food allergies, which may have happened anyway.
Yeah.
Yep. So there are some challenges there, but it sounds like she's really incredible.
Yeah. 19 food allergies. And I went to a allergist that I never went back to, but when he found this out, he said, I won't talk about this. It's going to overwhelm you. And I just, no, I'm not overwhelmed. Like, I'm overwhelmed when I get told to plan a funeral. This is nothing. She's alive. She's happy. She'll eat fish and vegetables for the rest of her life, I guess. I can handle this. it's crazy how your perspective changes. So nothing seems like that big of a deal anymore, as long as she's doing well.
Olivia, of course, we hope that no other mothers have to go through this. But if somebody else is in a situation like this, what would you tell them to do? What advice would you give?
I would say the first thing is to advocate for yourself and your child. I didn't realize that at first, that's something I needed to do. I honestly just took the doctor's word and believed that it was over, and or both the doctors that I had spoken to. And, you know, come to find out, I would tell anyone to always get a second and third opinion. and just never give up hope. One of the women that helped me through my situation, she had had her own situation the year before, reminded me, you know, doctors are not God, and they, you know, they don't know everything. And clearly in this case, had I listened before, I, you know, we wouldn't have our Kerrigan. And so I just feel, never give up hope, advocate for yourself, and don't be afraid to get second and third opinions.
Livia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Livia Knipp, her daughter Kerrigan was a micro preemie. She gave birth when Kerrigan was just 23 weeks, 6 days gestation. And Kerrigan is almost 2 years old now. This hour, we're talking about micro preemies. They're babies born before 26 weeks gestation or weighing less than 1 pound, 12 ounces. And with me, Dr. Jonathan Klein, director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. Hello, Dr. Klein.
Good morning.
And also with us, Dr. Andrea Greiner, Director of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Greiner, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And we were listening to Livia's story about, you know, her water broke at 19 weeks and she turned to her care team and was told that there was no hope. Then she went on Facebook and found out, oh, maybe there is hope. This seems like such a wild story, but this is something that you, both of you, have encountered quite frequently, right?
Very true. Yeah, we do on a pretty regular basis.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because, you know, here at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, this is something that you're doing on a regular basis, taking care of these micro preemies. But this is a relatively new thing, right?
So I think the major concern with her pregnancy was that her water broke before 24 weeks. And in the past, people consider this lethal because the literature would say if you rupture that early and your rupture goes on more than a week, you have pulmonary hypoplasia and have very little chance of survival. We found that if you can get, you know, close to past 22 weeks, even if you ruptured early, that with newer techniques, with high-frequency ventilation, newer surfactants, and inhaled nitric oxide, that these babies do have a much better chance of survival. So it's not an automatic, inevitable death. But that's only occurred recently. We've written a paper in the last few years about it. But it still takes a long time for that concept to spread to other NICUs and other obstetricians.
Let's talk about high-risk pregnancies and things like this happening to women around the state of Iowa. And Dr. Greiner, first of all, in Iowa, we see that there is less access to obstetric care in rural areas around the state than ever. And so you have women coming to you from all over the state of Iowa as well as out of state. How do you connect with the obstetric care that these women are receiving elsewhere to make sure they know what's available to them if they're experiencing a high-risk pregnancy?
So if patients have a history of a complicated pregnancy, their primary obstetrician or a family medicine physician or a midwife might refer them to us for a consultation at some point in their current pregnancy, and we will assess their risk factors for preterm birth and talk about that. We try to follow up with our providers when they refer us patients in the hospital. Certainly if they come to us in the clinic and we see them for a consult, we send them a consult note back. Our department does an annual conference every year, continuing education conference, and every so many years it's on issues related to prenatal care and pregnancy. We don't have sort of a otherwise regular way to do that. As a department, we are, we're recently, together with the Department of Public Health in Iowa, awarded a grant for maternal health innovation, and also are applying for a designation for levels of maternal care. And in both of those programs, we are expected to develop a more formal follow-up and feedback with referring providers. So going forward, we will have a more formal mechanism of education. But one of my colleagues currently travels around the state reviewing cases at hospitals, both in rural areas and urban areas, and talks about risk factors and talks about risk assessment and you know, how to manage women, pregnant women in certain scenarios and conditions, and when those patients can be managed locally and when they should be referred to us.
Let's talk a little bit about Livia's case, but also cases of other women who experienced something like this. I mean, as Dr. Klein was just saying, thinking about a woman's membranes rupturing at 19 weeks, that used to be a hopeless situation. It's still an incredibly terrifying situation. So if a woman comes to you in that condition, I mean, your goal is to keep her pregnant for as long as possible. How do you do that once the membranes have ruptured?
So my primary goal is to keep mom healthy.
Okay.
And if we can include keeping her pregnant as long as possible, then that we try to achieve that. But my first and foremost commitment is to mom and her health. And so this is not a common thing in general across pregnancies. Well, across all women, we see many of these patients here because they're referred to us. So it happens about 1% of the time that women will break their water prior to 24 weeks. I talk with them about how this happens. There's a hole somewhere in their bag of water. Why it happens, we don't usually know. We think it probably is because there is an infection brewing or inflammation brewing somewhere in their cervix or uterus that caused this to happen. We tell them that, just like Livia said, it doesn't usually reseal. The bag of water doesn't usually heal itself. They continue to leak fluid. Amniotic fluid is all baby urine, so as long as baby's kidneys work, they still leak. But we talk to them a lot about risks of infection and, you know, infection that ascends from the lower part of the genital tract and how that is risky for mom and risky for baby. And, you know, Livia talked a little bit about bleeding. Their placentas can start to separate early. And so we just talk with them about all these things. And sometimes patients defy the odds and they will stay pregnant. There isn't really anything that we do per se to keep them pregnant. We monitor them. We place them on antibiotics. We give them steroid shots when they get a little further along to help baby's lungs. But there's nothing we do that keeps them pregnant. It's just watching to see what nature is going to do and trying to watch for early signs that mom's health is compromised or baby's health is compromised. I think there is this idea that we're actively intervening in some way, excuse me, but we aren't really intervening. We are watching and
waiting for the moment when you have to intervene.
Right.
Yeah, Dr. Klein?
I think one of the important things that the high-risk obstetricians do at Iowa is that if these pregnancies get far enough along, they will give antenatal steroids earlier than many other centers. And I think that's very important. So they get the antenatal steroids, help to mature not just the lungs, but also the brain, the heart, the intestines, the kidneys. And our obstetricians do a very good job of getting that in. And they actually start that at 21 and 5/7 weeks. By starting it that early, if the pregnancy makes it to 22 weeks, our outcomes here over the past 12 years for babies that are resuscitated, survival is over 60%. The average nationally is 14%. One of the things that makes a massive difference is having that antenatal steroids on board. And so they do take sort of a proactive approach. And just that simple shot makes a massive difference if the baby does deliver that early.
And the mother also has to make a choice. The family has to make a choice at that stage, because water's rupturing at 19 weeks. That used to be considered a miscarriage with no hope. But a parent can also allow that to happen.
Correct. I mean, everything is family-centered. The mother is the primary patient of the obstetrician. you know, if the rupture is because of a rip-roaring infection, nothing's going to be able to stop that. They might rupture at 19 weeks and deliver 2 days later, and that's a miscarriage. But sometimes if we just actually sit back and not do anything, you know, other than monitor, there's always a chance that the baby will reach to a point that they could be viable. And with steroids at Iowa, that's after 22 and 0 sevenths.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the care of micropreemies, the smallest of premature babies. Dr. Jonathan Klein and Dr. Andrea Greiner from the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics are here with me now, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about micropreemies, babies born before 26 weeks gestation or weighing less than 1 pound, 12 ounces. And with me, Dr. Jonathan Klein, director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, and Dr. Andrea Greiner, director of maternal fetal medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And Dr. Klein, I want to revisit a point that you were making a moment ago, and that is that the survival opportunities for babies born this prematurely at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics have improved dramatically in recent years. So when doctors say, you know, think at 19 weeks of someone's membranes rupturing means that there is no hope, a few years ago there wasn't hope. And we also talked about the fact that when that happens, the mother has many risk factors for her own health. So this is a very difficult time, a time that needs a great deal of care for the mother and then possibly for the baby as well. Give me some statistics. So what are the survival rates for babies that are born 22 through 25 weeks, this very short window here?
So if you look at the last 12 to 13 years at University of Iowa, for babies born at 24 weeks, the survival is 86%, which is incredibly high. At 23 weeks, it's 75%, which is also incredibly high because 30 years ago, I would say that would be completely impossible. And at 22 weeks, it's up to 60%. Which 12 years ago I would have said would have been completely impossible. So a lot of changes have happened in the past 10 to 15 years at Iowa to help promote this. I mean, we do a first intention, what's called high-frequency ventilation strategy, which helps to protect the lungs. Our obstetricians give antenatal steroids, which makes the lung mature very rapidly within 12 hours, so that we break through this so-called biological threshold of viability. And we have the ability, when you're ruptured for more than a week, you can develop pulmonary hypertension. So we do have access to inhaled nitric oxide and modern surfactants. But more importantly, we have a gigantic team dedicated to the care of these micropreemies with a huge level of experience. And so by literally caring properly for over 200 22, 23, 24 weekers, you know, over the past, you know, 15 years there, there's developed a lot of experience with this population.
And Dr. Greiner, at any hospital, of course, there's the cooperation between the obstetrician team and those caring for babies as well. But tell me a little bit about your relationship with the NICU when you're working with women who are in these incredibly high-risk pregnancies.
I mean, I think we have a very close collegial relationship with our NICU colleagues. We talk to them a lot. We communicate with them. We meet with them on a regular basis to review our cases and our management, and both, you know, what we're doing on our side and what they're doing on their side. I've learned a lot in neonatology, and Dr. Klein and his colleagues have learned a lot of obstetrics. And so we have an understanding of each other's practices and how we impact each other. And we as a group of obstetricians, you know, we've really had to think a lot about how we practice and what we do. And that for many of us, it was very ingrained in our training that no babies survive prior to 24 weeks. And so for us to move that threshold is a big deal. And it's not so much that we are resistant to change because we embrace other changes, but for some reason that particular time point was very deeply embedded. But we've gotten there, and it's a lot of discussion and a lot of, well, what can we do and what does this mean and how do we do this the best way for moms and babies? And knowing that mom's health and baby's health are always a priority, and to not incur any additional risk in these already high-risk situations. But it's a lot of communication. Sometimes the discussion gets a little heated. But everybody has the same goal, and everybody is free to speak their opinions. And we find a lot of consensus, and we collaborate a lot. It's a good group.
And Dr. Klein, you mentioned to me earlier that you have colleagues from around the country, and probably from around the world as well, that look at your success rates and don't believe them, are actually shocked by what you've been able to do here at the University of Iowa.
So it's one of those things that when I would similar to when Columbus is sailing across the ocean and people thought, well, the world's flat and you'll fall off the edge. And then you come back and say, well, we didn't fall off. Well, did you really sail around the world? And when we started taking care of the babies at 22 weeks, the common refrain that I heard from many places when I present our data was, it's hardy farm stock, that Iowa babies only survive because of something special at Iowa that was inherent. And I tried
because they're Iowan.
Right.
All the okay. Corn and pork. Right.
And I tried to explain that, you know, not every Iowan lives on a farm. So eventually they understood that. And then we looked at our long-term outcomes, which were published recently. But that paper by my colleagues took 3 to 4 years to get published because they had no problem accepting that a 22-weeker could survive in Sweden or in Japan. But then in Iowa, the OBs here don't know how to date a pregnancy. The obstetricians in every country in the world and every state in the United States can date pregnancies, but our OBs can't. So it just took a long time to overcome that because people get ingrained in their mind that there's a biological threshold. In the past, it was 24 weeks. More recently, most places think it's 23 weeks. But in reality, with a very delicate approach and antenatal steroids and a positive proactive approach, it's like we said, the survival is over 60% at 22 weeks. And the long-term outcomes, more than 60% of these babies are basically normal at 18 to 24 months. So neurodevelopmental outcomes are quite good.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because it's one thing to survive. It's another thing to thrive. And these babies have a lot of challenges. And we were talking to Livia Knipp. You were part of the care team that took care of Kerrigan, her daughter, who was born so early. She was in the NICU for 135 days. So that's a really long period of time where these babies do need intensive care. Tell me a little bit more about some of the challenges that you face when you're working with a micropreemie.
So the main goal beyond survival is to have a neuroprotective strategy. So there are things that cannot get better with time, and there are things that will get better with time. So it's very important, we noted, to protect the brain from having a bleed. So that begins prenatally with antenatal steroids and begins with very careful management in the first couple weeks. And when you're trying to protect the brain, monitoring carbon dioxide levels closely, you trade off a little bit more lung injury, but the lungs will continue to grow up to age 8. The other things is you have to protect the intestines, and so it's really important to get maternal breast milk and to slowly, delicately have these babies adapt to extrauterine life and we try to get mom's breast milk is the best, but it still has to be fortified with extra protein because these babies the breast milk was never designed for 22 weeks. The eyes you want to protect because vision loss and vision impairment. Now, we know Kerrigan does wear glasses, so nearsightedness, I'm nearsighted, so I think it's okay. I don't consider that a major disability, but we want to prevent blindness, which we work very hard at. And one of the things that helps to prevent that is to use a little bit of extra oxygen toward discharge to allow the eyes to prevent severe ROP. So there's a lot that's going on at the same time.
And you mentioned blindness. I mean, some of the micropreemies who survive must wind up with some of these challenges? I mean, when you're looking at survival rates, do you break that down as far as, you know, the challenges you're also able to cope with or help prevent?
So we've always made preventing blindness a major priority. And there's a trade-off. And we know if we use a little bit more oxygen as the babies are getting closer to their due dates, that prevents the retinopathy from getting severe enough to risk retinal detachment or blindness or even laser intervention. So we've really not had any babies develop blindness, and we rarely ever need to have interventions with laser surgery. The trade-off is, just like Kerrigan is home on some oxygen, some of these babies will spend a few extra months, maybe a year or two, on oxygen, but for the next 87 years, they will have good vision, not have lost a peripheral vision, and not have be blind. To us, that's an important trade-off, and many things in neonatology have to be balanced.
Well, and so she spent 135 days in the NICU, but even after a child is sent home, even after they're ready to be in their home and cared for by their parents, micropremies also need some additional care along the way, is what I hear you saying.
So it's very important to have long-term follow-up with early infant intervention, with occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, to make sure you can maximize their development. You need to reassure the families that they don't develop. You can't look at a 12-month-old, 22-weeker, and read a baby book on a 12-month-old. You've got to look at what a 7-month-old might be doing. And then that reassures the families. And we would follow these babies up to 2.5 years. And we try to assist with their medical care, with their primary care physicians at home, and make sure they're hooked up with any other subspecialties that they might need. Now, Kerrigan did have some issues with pulmonary hypertension, which can become lethal if not detected and managed. So that's why she's still on oxygen. We'll leave her on her oxygen until we see signs that she's recovered from that. And that's a common finding in babies who rupture this early and have pulmonary hypoplasia because of the lack of lung growth for those 4 weeks, 4 to 5 weeks that she had minimal fluid.
These advances in care for micropremies are so recent. Has there been research done into the longer term outcomes? You mentioned that you'll care through about 2.5 years old, but has there been research done into how this might affect a child when they're 12 years old or 16 years old or an adult?
Well, these babies have only been surviving at 22 weeks for, you know, basically 5 to 10 years. And so we would certainly continue to follow our cohort of patients and publish that data as it comes back. We certainly know there are 24-weekers that I've attended their college graduations that have jobs. And if you can work on protecting the brain and the eyes from the beginning, they tend to go on to have a life like anyone else. But they certainly do encounter challenges. It's not normal. The brain does not develop normally ex utero as it does in utero. And one of my former patients, who's a reporter, and she's 25, she says she doesn't understand sarcasm. So it's just fascinating that she has to make it clear to people, don't be facetious, don't be sarcastic. I don't understand that. Just be straightforward with me. And that could be related to more complex levels of brain development that we just don't understand yet.
Oh, that's fascinating. Give me an idea of how many babies you care for in a year in your NICU.
Well, so the NICU as a whole admits over 900 patients a year, but in terms of very low birth weight, under 3 pounds, 4 ounces, it's about 168 patients a year.
All right. And the babies that are in the NICU, as you mentioned, I mean, they're not all these micropremies. You're caring for also premature babies that are born after 26 weeks gestation.
And what's more of a challenge is actually there are a lot of babies with congenital anomalies or birth defects. Our obstetricians get patients from all over the state that have prenatally diagnosed problems. They could have, a very common one is diaphragmatic hernia. There's congenital heart disease patients, and there's just kidney anomalies. It goes on. And it's a huge challenge when it's a challenge enough to have a premature baby, with and but it's also a challenge to have a term baby who is missing major organ systems.
Yeah. We have just a couple of minutes left here, and Livia Knipp gave some advice to other mothers who might go through a situation similar to hers. But Dr. Greiner, can you give mothers who are expecting or will be expecting some advice on how to look for information, how to get the support that they need?
So I think Livia's advice of advocating for yourself and finding information, I think, are critical. And I think a lot of, or if not most of our pregnant patients do that. They do advocate for themselves, and we have no shortage of information about pregnancy these days. And so they can certainly find lots of information. I think I want everyone to think about, yes, most pregnancies turn out well and everybody does fine, but complications happen. And to ask your obstetrician or your family practice doctor or your midwife, you know, what things do I need to watch out for and what things should I call you about? You know, like Livia talked about, you know, feeling like her water broke, and patients will say, well, I didn't think this could happen at this point, but anything can happen at any point. And while, yes, we want everybody to have a perfect, normal, uncomplicated pregnancy, that just isn't the reality. And that's why I have a job. And so I think to find some balance between having some level of awareness of what to watch out for, but yet to not let it overwhelm you, and that, you know, yes, most women will be healthy and things will turn about fine, but when something isn't quite right, trust your intuition. Mom's intuition is strong and it's real. And so if something doesn't seem quite right, even if it's different than what your provider is telling you, question it and ask questions. And really, I agree with Livia, don't be afraid to advocate for yourself.
And get a second opinion.
Absolutely.
If you need one.
Yep.
Do you feel like there's a danger of misinformation out there as well right now?
Absolutely. Right. I mean, get lots of sources. I mean, there's lots of information. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, but who's quoting it and where is it coming from? And, you know, people have the best of intentions, but there is information out there that's just not accurate.
All right. And Dr. Klein, having moved the needle on taking care of micropreemies to create a situation where you can regularly save babies who are born at 22 weeks gestation, do you feel like the practices that you've put into place are spreading?
Yes. So we actually started talking about many of our approaches back in 2015, and we've noticed nationally the survival has been climbing. It's starting to almost double from what it was at that gestation 10 years ago.
Well, thank you both so much for being
thank
here
you.
Today. Dr. Jonathan Klein, Director of the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, and Dr. Andrea Greiner, Director of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.